Over the past few weeks, we've been looking at one of the biographers of Jesus' life. His name is Matthew. And in the first chapter, we read the genealogy of Jesus. And at first glance, you think, this is a bit cumbersome. But here's what he does. It's unheard of. Is that Matthew like airs all the dirty laundry in Jesus' family tree. So he says this. He says that Jesus is related to cheaters and liars and a murderer and a prostitute and people who were deemed unworthy in that culture. And why would Matthew do that? He wants everybody to know Jesus inserted himself into the dysfunction of humanity. And he wasn't afraid of us. He didn't require us to sanitize ourselves before he could become a part of our world. And we looked last week at Joseph, teenage boy who has no idea what's going on. But God says, I want you to step up to the plate and I want you to believe that I'm doing something that you can't explain. And he gives us this beautiful picture of masculinity and obedience where he says, okay, God. Here's where I'd like us to look. Matthew introduces an idea, and it's going to be a theme throughout his book, and it's unique. Here's the theme, is that Jesus is king. Jesus is king. Now, what does that mean, and why is that important to Matthew? Well, he's going to introduce us to the wise men, or the magi, as they're often called. And he's going to say these magi and this idea that Jesus is king are essential for us to understand what's really happening in the Christmas story. So we're going to read about the magi, but I want to set them up just a little bit. There are actually quite curious people. We don't know a lot historically about the Magi. We're told they come from the East. We think most likely from the ancient kingdom of Babylon. We call that Iraq in today's world. And they're astrologers, astronomers. They view the night sky and they see this celestial sign. It's a phenomenon that they realize this is significant. Whatever is happening in the night sky tells them that a new king is being born, and this is not like any other king. They're scribes, they're historians, they're advisors to kings, they're very learned men. So when they see this star in the night sky, they know there's a king being born, they're gonna follow that star. So what was their journey like? So if you were a wise man and you needed to head west, what would you do? You'd jump on Google Maps, right? And you plot a course, and this is what it would look like. Now, notice on the far right is Iraq, Baghdad, which is where Babylon was. And notice they go all the way, 212 hours of walking, okay? It's about 793 miles. And it would have taken them, depending on how many hours they walked a day, somewhere between 28 and 40 days. It's a long journey. What else do you notice about that map? Yeah, you notice that between Baghdad in Damascus, there just isn't much out there. There's not a tree to be seen. This is an arduous journey. This is a journey where you are planning out every stop because you need water. But they determine this is worth it because a king is born. Let's read Matthew chapter 2. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod. Herod is the Jewish king. He serves underneath the Roman emperor. Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw a star when it rose and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah, the word Messiah is a Hebrew word, means the promised or anointed one. It's the one that Jewish people prayed for at least twice a day, the one that God had promised would come and heal everything that was broken with human beings, where the Messiah was to be born. In Bethlehem in Judea, they replied, "For this is what the prophet has written." Micah wrote this hundreds of years before. "But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people, Israel." Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may worship him." Now, Herod has no intentions whatsoever worshiping Jesus. We won't read the end of the chapter, But in fact, Herod feels so threatened, he's going to commit an atrocious genocide. He's going to have every young boy in all of Bethlehem killed to try to eliminate Jesus. After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary and bowed down and worshiped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. Jesus as a king. What does this mean? I just want to give you three thoughts on the Christmas story. Number one is this. If Jesus is king, it means that there's going to be a confrontation. A confrontation. Now, I know that's a word that most of us were hoping to avoid this Christmas. If you have people over, sometimes have you ever had this? Okay, listen, everyone. It's usually grandma. She says, no discussing politics, right? And then some of our families, we got to say, no football talk. No Grizz, Bobcat. It starts off kind of fun, and then it turns nasty, right? We don't want confrontation, right? We want peace. But Jesus, coming as a king, creates what in King Herod? Disturbance. He's greatly disturbed. Let me tell you just a little bit about Herod. He had fought a four-year-long battle in order to gain the throne in Jerusalem. Thousands of people had died in this battle. He took the throne by force. And in the 36 years that he'd been king up to this moment, this is his own family members that he had eliminated because he felt threatened by them. Three of his biological sons he had assassinated. A wife, his father-in-law, his mother-in-law, and his uncle. Herod had spent an entire lifetime playing the ultimate game of King of the Hill. He was on top, and he would eliminate anyone who threatened him. He wanted to be in absolute control and power. He hoped that no one would ever be able to usurp his throne. One of the things that Matthew seems to be hinting at to us is this, is that it's not just Herod that has a problem with there being a new king. It's all of us as well. It's every man, it's every woman. And in the story of the struggle for the throne begins all the way back in Genesis chapter 3, the third chapter in the Bible, where the first human beings, Adam and Eve, they're not so sure that they shouldn't be in charge. And part of their original rebellion against God is, I want to be queen. I want to be king. Why can't I decide what's right and wrong? Why can't I call the shots? Why can't I determine my own destiny? And since that point in time, every human being has struggled with there being someone who has ultimate authority over their lives. Matthew says, when Jesus has come as a child, he's king. He's king. We have to decide what we'll do with a new king. Here's the second thought. It's not just a confrontation, but there's these challenging expectations. Challenging expectations. So imagine with me if you were one of these magi and you had spent 3-4 weeks traveling across an arid desert, and your expectations would be fairly high, wouldn't they? You'd seen this star. This is a phenomenon that no one has ever seen before. And you're going to find the new king, a king that's announced in the heavens. And you're going to think, we'll find him in the palace in Jerusalem. We'll find him with attendants. We'll find him with royalty. But when they go to the palace, there's no king. So they keep following the sign, and they end up in this little village called Bethlehem. There's no palace. And they come to a simple little house. And when they walk in, what do they see? A peasant girl, a teenager. You can tell from her clothing, she's not wealthy. She's not a queen. She doesn't look like a princess. There's a little boy in her arms. Imagine what their expectations must have been compared to what they actually see. All of us bring expectations for God. We have them. Like we expect that if God is truly king, if he's truly good, I hear this. I feel this in my own life. My life should be less painful? If God's truly king, why am I still lonely? Why am I experiencing financial distress? Why is my family still so dysfunctional? God, if you're king, you have not met my expectations. And part of the story of Christmas and the story of Matthew's book is this. People had expectations for who Jesus would be and what he would do, and they missed him because they were expecting a man who would ascend to a throne, raise an army, overthrow the Roman government, bring them back to a place of political and financial success and influence in the world. But this king, did not come to eliminate foreign powers. This king came to fight a battle that no one knew needed to be fought. And so the wise men bend their expectations around the reality of what God is doing. In a similar way, I think Matthew invites us with our disappointment, with our frustrations towards God, to bend our expectations around what he is actually doing. Here's the third thing that Matthew shows us. He shows us, how do you respond to a new king? What do you do if there's truly a new king? And I love that he lays out three distinct things that the wise men do. First thing they do is, it says, they're overjoyed. Love that word. I've never used that word. Like, nobody's ever given me a gift and I looked at him and go, I'm overjoyed. But I know what it means because it's a very descriptive word. I use other words like I overindulged or I'm overwhelmed or overworked, right? It means I've got joy and it's so big I can't contain it. And so they're overjoyed. Now, why? Compare their response to Herod's response. Herod feels disturbed and he feels threatened. The Magi, they're filled with joy. They're not threatened. Why? Here's what these wise men understood. The story of humanity has been this. God is here. Human beings are here. And we understand, we know intuitively that there is a gap that exists between God and human beings. So what has humankind done to try to bridge the gap? We have created unending religious systems. We've said if human beings could just be more devout, be more moral, if we could do more, try harder, maybe we could inch our way back to God. But it's failed. Here's what the wise men knew. Here's why they're overjoyed. They realize is they are standing before a peasant woman and a little boy that God has joined the human condition. That the chasm between God and humanity has been addressed, and not through human effort, but through divine intervention. Through the King of Kings being born. They're overjoyed. Their second response is this. They bow and they worship. They bow and they worship. In our culture, if it'd just be weird, like if you met someone in the atrium and they just bowed before you, you'd be like, stop, that's weird, get up, right? In fact, in our culture, if you're on your knees like this, what's gonna happen next? This, right? It means you're in trouble, okay? Put your hands behind your back, get on your knees. In this culture, you have these learned scholars, they see this little baby, and rather than just admire him, like, oh, look how cute he is, they drop to their knees in an act of worship, which is this posture of saying, I humble myself before you. There's no palace, you're not meeting my expectations, but I believe that you are the king and you've come to change the world. Here's one of the challenges in our culture. We live in this beautiful free culture, and I think most human beings admire Jesus. We just admire him. I've read with, I don't know, dozens of friends who are skeptical, they're trying to figure out what they believe. I say, hey, just read one of the biographies of the life of Jesus. And no one has ever read Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John and come back and go, eh. You just admire him. If it's true, you can't help but admire a human being who lived that way, said those things, loved that deeply, was that sacrificial, that bold, that courageous. It's just beyond anything that any human being could ever do. Christmas isn't just about admiring him. It's not just about the sentimentality where once a year I think, boy, I'm really happy you came to earth. What Matthew is saying is this, is there is a king and you're going to have to determine what your response will be as a human being. Will you just admire him? Or will you bow? An act of submission and worship. Their third response is they gave gifts. They gave gifts. And the gifts are gold, frankincense, and myrrh. So this is not your typical first century baby shower, okay? They didn't bring Pampers and onesies. They brought gold, frankincense, and myrrh. One of those makes sense to us, right? Gold. Like, bring gold to a baby shower, people will be happy. They're gonna be like, hey, thank you very much, right? So that makes sense. The point is they're very expensive gifts. Myrrh is aromatic spice. It was used in burial. It was used to burn incense. Frankincense, I've had like this lifelong quest to really figure out what frankincense was. I've never, even like reading and research, I can't get a good grasp on it until 2 years ago. Our son-in-law was living in the Middle East. He came to visit us and he brought a box of frankincense. And I'm like, this is it. This is gonna be fantastic. So I open it and it looks, it kind of looks like taffy. And I said, well, what do I do with it? And he said, you chew it like gum. I said, okay. The gift they gave to Jesus, and I put the first piece in my mouth. And you know what it was like? Exactly like eating pine sap. It was this huge disappointment. It felt like I was licking a tree. You're just like, oh, my teeth were sticking together. I'm like, why bring this to Jesus? This is a horrible gift. It was incredibly rare. It was only for nobility. But the point is they bring these gifts. Christmas is about this. The first gift that was given. You know why we give gifts? Because the first gift that was given is God giving you, giving me a second chance. Hope. His son. And this Christmas, I guarantee you that God doesn't need your gold or your frankincense or your myrrh. The most precious thing that you can give God, the most valuable thing by far, is your heart, your worship, your allegiance, your surrender. Our kids are older now, but for many years, I was always a little bit concerned with the fact that they seem to kind of unintentionally mix up two big characters in the Christmas story, Santa and Jesus. And it kind of get interwoven and interlocked, and I kind of see why. Here's the thing with Santa. Your relationship with Santa is purely transactional, okay? You know what that means? It means that he's got two lists, a naughty list and a nice list. And the point is to get onto the nice list. And how do you get on the nice list? You behave correctly, right? And parents, we've learned how to leverage this starting like in August, right? Your kid misbehaves and you like can sing back this super creepy song. He knows when you are sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows when you've been bad or good. So the picture is this, is, you know, Santa's like, ooh, naughty, naughty. So the goal is get on the nice list, because if you're not on the nice list, what happens? Santa flies to Gillette, Wyoming, loads up some coal, brings it back, and gives you a piece of it. In fact, it gets even worse in other cultures. My wife, brother married a gal from Poland, and we were sharing Christmas together, and we were talking about different American Christmas traditions and Polish Christmas traditions, and they have it way worse. If you behave poorly, this is what they do with their kids. There's this character, a real character, well, not real, but they say it's a real character called Krampus, and Krampus comes and abducts children who have misbehaved. Like, give me coal any day. That's like a terrible tradition. The Anti-Claus, you know, he comes and steals you away. So the whole thing is you kind of get nervous, and here's what happens. We end up mixing up story of Jesus and the story of Santa Claus, and we often think that our relationship with Jesus is transactional. If you behave well, he'll treat you well. But Matthew tells us this. This Jesus is a king. And as a king, he took the naughty list. I've got really bad news for you. Your name's on here. My name's on here. Abraham Lincoln's on here. Mother Teresa. Because nobody could get off the naughty list. This is what the king did. He said, let's change the dynamics between God and human beings. Let's not make this transactional any longer. A human relationship with God is not based upon your moral performance. It's based upon this. God would come to earth as a king and live the life that we could never live and give himself to eliminate the naughty list, to make new life and hope and forgiveness possible. That's the story of King Jesus. Would you pray with me? Lord, it's Christmas. We do not want to be only admirers of your life, of what you've done. Matthew lets us know that a response is required. So would you teach us what it means to bow and to worship, to understand that this king has come to change everything, that no longer is our relationship with God based upon something transactional and behavioral, but it's based upon this. The king came for us. And so our response is to bow and to worship the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. I wonder if you keep your eyes closed for just a moment. I just want to create an opportunity for anyone in the room, if this would be that moment in your life where you would bow your knee, you would surrender to him, and you would say, Jesus, I follow you. If you'd just boldly raise your hand, catch my eye if you would, please. Yeah, absolutely. New start for you. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. Right here in front. Yeah. Over there. Yeah. Your son, your daughter. Anybody else? If that's you, will you catch my eye? Okay. Yeah. Beautiful. Beautiful. If you're in the balcony, will you wave at me if that's you? Okay. There. There. Yeah. You're his. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, absolutely. I see you up there. Love it. Hey, everybody, would you join me in celebrating a bunch of brave people made a big decision. Love it, love it.